Record 11:15. Okay, so again, Dr. Farrell is here today for the chart audit review of 18-08-C. We've, since this agreement was set in place, we've only reviewed two depression cases. Dr. Farrell had not been doing any. So we have to determine if that is a satisfactory amount, or should we keep the case open to review or specifically whether it's due? Or just to make sure that the pattern has, you know, that it's a, you know, a continuation of appropriate treatment. And, you know, the other issues that we've been discussing too aren't directly related to what we're discussing on this, so those things we can discuss at later dates. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay, so any other discussion concerning that? I mean, if you, you know, I personally feel two cases is not enough. So I would, my opinion would be to keep the case open and have Dr. Farrell continue to inform the board of his nerve decompression cases and to appropriately send documentation of those to Heather when those occur. And that's a monthly, that's supposed to occur on a monthly basis.
I agree.
I agree.
Mr. Rhodes?
Cases.
You there?
Yes.
Okay, so I will make a motion to continue the audit as previously set forth.
Second.
Any discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? So moved.
Aye.
Thank you, Mr. Rhodes. Thank you, Dr. Farrell. So we will move on.
Thank you. I'll take your suggestions.
Okay. Our next is under 5C. That would be Dr. Michael Brewer. This is in regards to last month's non-disciplinary order for continuing education. The case number is 19-29-B. And the doctor is present with his counsel, Mr. Whittakin. Whittakin? I don't want to chop your name up. So, okay, so Heather, do you want to give a quick synopsis? You want me to do that? What happened with?
I can. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the board. At its December 11th meeting, the board reviewed this complaint number 1929. It was opened because of a malpractice matter that was reported on his renewal. And at last month's meeting, the December 11th meeting, the board determined that it didn't rise to a violation of Rutledge statute, but there were some concerns. So the board issued a non-disciplinary order for continuing education. A couple of weeks after the meeting, I don't remember the exact date, but that was sent to Dr. Brewer, and he was not in attendance at the meeting. I spoke with Dr. Brewer, and there was some discussion regarding noticing and not receiving some correspondence from the board office. But he did end up getting the order for non-disciplinary continuing education, and just subsequently, I think it was a day or two after that, that he received it and we spoke. He sent me a request to come before the board and discuss the order and just give him a chance, I think, to speak before the board regarding the case. So it's on today's agenda for that purpose. And his attorney is with him today.
And would I be incorrect in saying that maybe the impression that had been given to Dr. Brewer was because the malpractice case that he was the assistant.
Correct.
So that there was no liability for him, but when we receive complaints and it's on your, you know, national practitioner data, or he didn't get anything from the national practitioner data bank, but it behooves the board, that's part of what we do, is we have to investigate the complaint. And when we don't have the complaint there with counsel, we, you know, this is how we proceeded from what we saw, because I think our main concern was, even though you were the assistant surgeon, our thought was he still has some responsibility in, you know, addressing, you know, if you saw that the extensor was as long as tendon should have been addressed, you know, did you discuss that with, you know, so that's why we want to talk to you.
And if I may, I might be able to put it in perspective. I was counsel in the underlying malpractice case for both of the surgeons. This was a gentleman, an impressive gentleman, former special ops, FBI agent. He was working at home and he dropped a circular saw. Dr. Dela Cruz was called in for surgery. Dr. Brewer was not involved. There was a complete transaction of the which Dr. Dela Cruz prepared, put a sheet around it, by the way. He saw a incomplete transplant cut of the accessor, the PHI, which he elected not to repair. The patient followed up to Dr. Dela Cruz 3 weeks later, reported that, contrary to instructions, this was a hard-charging guy, but he had walked in, he tripped, MRI was done, and it now showed that so there was a second surgery. Dr. Brewer was solely an assistant surgeon. There was a EMR template that was in the hospital chart that had Dr. Brewer listed as the primary surgeon. During that repair, the EHL, that surgery, the EHL was repaired. Questions as to Dr. Brewer was the chief. The problem for Dr. Dela Cruz was there were some documentation issues. He was a patient of finding a partial injury to the EHL during the first surgery was in his progress notes, but it wasn't in his original op report. More significantly, the op report for the second surgery could not be found. That was Dr. Brewer's role. He brought in the documentation, or if Dr. Dela Cruz was it. But for a variety of reasons, the case was settled by Dr. Dela Cruz. Dr. Brewer, however, he was named only because his name was identified in the medical record. When I hear what the facts were, Dr. Brewer was voluntarily dismissed on the case with prejudice, which was
right.
There was no settlement taken up what has been him. Dr. Dela Cruz and Dr. Brewer both were up for relicensing. This issue they reported that they had been named as Dr. Polakoff did the case review, and she expressly found, and I'm not just playing with my phone, that Dr. Brewer complied fully with the applicable standard of care in his role as why you are not anticipating the additional CME. The CME that's been recommended is $6 on tendon repair, which is not the and medical records. There were a couple of medical records issues in the case, but they were both asked about it. It was only $6, but as the board may understand, so ramifications, even from a non-disciplinary board. Surgeons. Others are not necessarily as qualified as trauma cases. Additional hours of CME and repairs. Some clever doctor, or maybe bottom line is, I think we weren't here for the December 11 hearing because at the time the report specifically said that Dr. Brewer applied fully to the application of care. I think my assumption was that the board wanted directed at Dr. Delafield, which under the circumstances would have seemed quite appropriate to me, but I don't think that it was necessarily appropriate to direct that. And so what we're asking for is modification and actual decision of the non-disciplinary order for the additional CME and medical care, which weren't issues or allegations. Are there any questions? And Dr. Baru, would this?
So, again, the first case, the first surgery was Dr. De La Cruz was the only.
Correct.
Surgeon. And then.
I think he probably
and
had.
And second surgery, Dr. Baru was the assistant.
That's correct. And in fact, there was a third surgery because
right.
after
Dr.
that,
Corey.
The patient had a re-tear of both, the, according to the MRI, both the EHL and the TAM.
Yes.
That was repaired by an orthopedic surgeon, except for that upper surgery. Third surgery, but again, Dr.
Right.
Brewer was not involved in that one.
So, no. Something on the tip. And I mean, I can, you know, certainly understand, you know, your the concern about the, you know, risk to, you know, the doctor as far as, you know, what staffs are going to say is like, oh, you know, you have this action against you and, you know, and are you, does that change your ability to do stuff? And they, no, that wasn't, you know, that wasn't the intent. Again, like I said, I think we were concerned with the fact that if he was in that surgery and didn't say something, and that to me, this, you know, it's not totally, you know, one of our statutes says, you know, if you, it behooves a physician to, you know, say something or bring something up to a colleague that could be potentially harmful to a patient. And I think that was kind of, you know, where we were with that. Of course, then the fact that you weren't here to talk to us, you know, we make decisions on what we have when we don't have the other parties involved. So it's nice that you're here today so that we could,
in fact,
talk about this.
So as to Dr. De La Cruz, because he had to make the same decision, but at the time, the only question was whether there was going to be reapproval of the license. And as to both of them, the recommendation was reapproval of the license. So that, I'm sure, is why Dr. De La Cruz didn't come. But as to Dr. Brewer, the report specifically said he complied fully with the act. No allegations against him during the case that he failed to do something when he was the assistant surgeon. Gel was repaired by Dr. De La Cruz. Find Dr. De La Cruz's operative report, and that was a big problem in the case.
If I may say something, I'm not sure how the impression was gotten that the tendons were not repaired during that surgery. It's my understanding that the problem is with medical records. The date of the surgery was during our transition month. We have a fellowship. Dr. De La Cruz comes from an academic institution where oftentimes residents and fellows are doing the majority of the documentation. So unfortunately, you know, he relied on a template that I had programmed and it was not completed. That's how my name got on that document. However, I can say that Dr. De La Cruz is excellent at tendon repair. I've done thousands of tendon repairs. We take call at, you know, I think it's 3 level 1 trauma centers. We have call contracts with 7 hospitals. And I've had an ER doctor fly his niece from New Jersey so that I could do her tendon repairs. And on top of all of it, we do have, you know, some orthopedic groups who are, you know, behaving in a problematic way where, you know, general orthopedists who don't have expertise in some of these foot and ankle issues are trying to, you know, maintain their positions for monetary reasons. And that ultimately results in patients having poorer outcomes. So, you know, I was not aware of the meeting on December 11th. Had I been aware, I would have been here. But, yeah, my goal would be that request for continuing education be rescinded.
Do you gentlemen have any questions?
No, no questions in this.
No questions.
Okay, thanks. What was it, 6 hours intending repair and 2 hours of documentation? Oh. Well, and a comment to you. I know you have your residents and stuff, but again, and this is just general. I mean, not so much maybe directed, you know, just think about is the fact that if you've got residents or fellows under you, you're still the captain of the ship.
Except and for you, in this case, I was not.
Right, I know. This is just general discussion. I'm not like pointing at, you know, so just as something I was, thinking of with this. So, I mean, after, you know, learning a little bit more about this, you know, from your aspect of it, and I don't know how my colleagues here feel, but I would be, I would entertain, you know, removing the, you know, the non-disciplinary CME and in its place offering a letter of concern.
Sure, and look at the new information, absolutely.
And direct just a letter of concern about the fact that if, you know.
So the board is concerned about me for what reason?
I'm getting ahead of myself here to back up. Because again, I think if we still have that the concern is not here now that of what we thought of before was that he should, you know, the situation of the way the surgeries were done and who was actually the
surgeon.
Actually, then a letter of concern really isn't going to accomplish and it doesn't mean anything. So I think I would move to rescind the non-disciplinary order for CME. Dr. Brewer? Any discussion on that? I want to make sure we're all on the same page here and that we've got all the information that we need. Mr. Rhodes?
Yes, would it be non-disciplinary, then would it be something on record keeping we would initiate?
Well, the patient wasn't the doctor's, he was not the primary physician. It would have been the responsibility of Dr. De La Cruz to do the documentation and paperwork. The only time an assistant would be, I mean, if for instance, there was some emergent thing that happened and Dr. De La Cruz wasn't available, maybe Dr. Brewer had to see the patient, then yes, he would be responsible for his documentation. But that didn't occur in this case.
I can assure that Dr. De La Cruz will confirm that he actually thought he was very involved trying to find the op report, thought he had completed it. Refer to your table counsel, but the question ultimately would be whether the complaint is dismissed or is there order with it, and so the order was non-disciplinary. Our request would be that the complaint.
Yeah, we would take it in two steps. The first is we have a motion to rescind the non-disciplinary order for CME. Once that motion is acted upon, then you have to decide what to do with the case, and if you think dismissal, outright dismissal is appropriate, then we can enter.
Right. So I did make the motion, and I believe it was seconded by Dr. Foreman. Discussion
motion.
Occurred, so we'll take a vote on that initial to rescind the motion for the non-disciplinary CME for Dr. Brewer, case number 19-29-B. And it's been seconded by Dr. Foreman. Any other discussion? All in favor? Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? So moved. Okay.
Aye.
Thank you, Mr. Rhodes. So now, as Mr. Harris said, then we have to decide the dispensation of the case. Should it be dismissed with no action? Or
I make a motion to dismiss the case. Action.
Finding no violation of state statute. Okay. Second?
Second.
Any?
Second.
Thank you, Mr. Rhodes. Any other discussion? All in favor? Aye. Opposed?
Aye.
Thank you so much. Thank you, gentlemen.
Heather, thank you for your
thank you.
All righty. Okay, next is D. We have an initial national analysis for Dr. Jamie Coffey. That was received by Heather. Heather, you want to?
So this is before the board because the board office received an NPDB report. It was dated, the NPDB report was dated about a year ago, but as I was looking through files, I found it, and I don't see that it was ever reported on his 2018 or his 2019 renewal application. So I'm bringing it before the board today to see if the board would like to open a complaint or just take no action on it. Dr. Coffey did provide a response, and basically his response is just letters from his attorney, who was the attorney for the malpractice matter, and from what I can tell, and I'm not an expert in reading these, but it doesn't even look like there was an actual malpractice matter, that it was just an informal claim that was made. So that's my summary, unless you guys have any questions of me.
With the national, do you know when, did Dr. Coffey ever tell you when he got that report? Because, you know, I'm looking at the timetable here. The settlement date was 8/24/18. It was processed on 8/31. He did his renewal application in 2/19 on 6/24/19. So I would have assumed that he would have had that in his possession.
But it's considered a malpractice case. So
I know.
Look at the lettering and the licensing.
Yeah.
So he, in my opinion, he answered that as correctly because he was not a malpractice case.
Mm. Right. But yeah, exactly. So Ben, this kind of brings up a separate issue: is our application misleading? Because if they're going to, you know, if you get a national, even though it never went, there's still that complaint. The data bank still sends a report. And when we see that and we think, aha, this doctor wasn't truthful in their application, do we need to add, did you have a settlement? Do something like that need to be added to that application to so that we don't have that issue that did you have a claim? Was there a settlement claim or what have you? I mean, is that make sense, or is that appropriate? Or
The way the question on the renewal reads now is, have you been named as a defendant in a medical malpractice matter during the 12 months before the date of this renewal application?
One of the things that we could do is take a look at other health boards to see on their renewal applications the type of questions that they ask, and maybe bring that information back to you to see if our renewal applications should be modified in any way to be a little bit more inclusive. Because right now it's very specific.
I mean, yeah, he was correct in doing that, but you know, in the way he filled out his, and of course in 18 he wouldn't have been aware of it anyway. So, yeah, that's something we can just ask Russ Stoner at the Federation. He can run a call out to the boards and that at another time and another agenda item. So, you know, with this just being initial analysis, I don't think we need to open a complaint against Dr. Coffey.
No action.
So, any discussion? I've moved and seconded. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
Aye.
So moved. All righty. So, all right. We can go on to that. Issuances of licenses. E. I think we have a young physician here. Dr. Brock is here too. I think just to kind of, she has questions or wants to discuss her license application. So when we look at, we've got several applications here for licensure. Our first is Dr. Barlow. And Dr. Barlow is currently in good standing in her residency at the Phoenix VA and will complete her residency in 6:30 of 20. So she can have her license issued when we receive the acknowledgement that her residency program has been successfully completed. Our next applicant.
Do we need a motion for that?
Yeah, we do. Yeah. So because of her situation, I would make a motion to issue a license to Dr. Megan Barlow upon receipt of successful completion of her residency program, which is 6:30 of 20, and payment of her appropriate fee.
Second.
Any discussion? All in favor? Aye. Opposed?
Aye.
So moved. Dr. Brock, Kara Brock, is our next application. She's down here in Tucson with Dr. Dancho, and the letter that was included indicates that her graduation date is 6:30 of 20, and that's when he expects her to complete the program. So again, we can't issue a license until receipt of that application, because according to what Dr. Dancho said, she has is due to complete, but at this point in time is not completed.
Seconded.
Any discussion for, I'm sorry. Pardon me, Dr. Brock. Do you have some questions you'd like to address the board?
Madam President and members of the board, thank you for the opportunity to speak. I'm requesting consideration of the board to approve me a licensing number currently. With my application as is, I have no intents to practice until the completion of my residency successfully in June 30th of 2020. I just to further explain what my dilemma has been, I a few months ago did receive a job offer for a federal institution in the state of Arizona. So at that point, I was also aware that the board does not usually submit a license number until your completion, because the standard currently at the federal institutions, even in the state of Arizona, is they recommended me to go get a license in the state of Utah because they don't require the additional documentation. I did end up declining that job offer, and instead I'm going to be joining a community hospital here in Arizona. But for me to receive a contract with them and to receive hospital credentialing and privileging to be started on the application process for insurance companies, they're requiring me to get a licensing number prior to me signing a contract. I did review the statutes on the board. I see that in 32-826A, I'm required to provide satisfactory proof of completion of my residency. And I'm requesting the board's consideration that my letter from Dr. Dancho or any other additional documentation that you may request be provided for the licensing number, once again, without any intent to practice until my completion.
We've had this discussion before with, the insurance companies, playing that, but it's our state statute. And like I said, in the past, there have been people from the program down there who we had letters said that they had successfully completed their programs, but your letter from Dr. Dancho indicates that you graduate on June 30th, and as per our statutes, license numbers, we can't give them out. That's just, it would be a violation of our state statute. And we certainly understand your concern, you want to start working, et cetera, but the insurance companies don't dictate state statutes.
If
you have any other remark, it may be better explanation for.
From time to time, the board receives these requests, but unfortunately, not until all the conditions for issuance of a license are met, can they even issue a license number? One, a license number won't be generated for your application until you have submitted all documentation confirming that you've met all the requirements. So I think while individually the board would like nothing more than to be able to assist you, they just at this time are not able to grant your request.
If I may speak, I did see that on your meeting in April 10th of 2019, you did issue Dr. Durfee and Dr. Hiapo a license number in their last 6 months of graduation, and I was hoping for the same consideration.
Yeah, I think the difference in those cases, and I don't have any of those materials in front of me, but my understanding was that those applicants had completed their residency and had obtained written verification that was submitted to the board that they have completed all of the requirements and there was nothing left.
And I would like to clarify, I have completed all requirements of my residency, and Dr. Dancho is agreeable to provide any proof other than I'm not able to submit a certification, an actual stamp certification except for postdated, because the hospital requires a 36-month residency. And so Dr. Dancho did leave in his, I have the letter here if you'd like to review any of his contact information, any documentation. I've completed all my surgical numbers. I've completed all my rotations. My residency is complete except for the time frame currently.
And you know, certainly, Dr. Kerr, I don't want to misspeak for the board, and I don't want to provide you with any false hope. But if, in fact, those facts are the same as those predecessors, I'm sure the board would consider that information. And maybe after this meeting, you can communicate with Heather to see exactly what is missing and what would necessarily be helpful for the board to reconsider your request.
So just to clarify, would the board have a consideration to approve my license currently pending the documentation proper from Dr. Dancho?
I appreciate your zealousness, but again, I think we're just trying to get too far ahead of ourselves, and it's really important for the board to treat everybody the same and not make special accommodations. I will say, I think if you can present evidence that everything has in fact been completed, but for the fact of the conferment of the certificate, I'm sure that that is something that the board will consider, and if they're comfortable with it, will consider granting your request.
Do you hold a license in any other state?
I was in process to apply for the state license in Utah, which I would have been approved for without any conflicts, and would have been able to secure employment in Arizona in that stance. But currently, I do not have the state license for Utah.
Because that would make a picture a little differently. So, and that, you know, because you could apply by what we call a you couldn't apply by comedy because you hadn't been practicing, but you could have, you know, that could have been a different step, which would have been helpful. So again, you know, we can hold, we'll keep this open and then request further information from Dr. Dancho. Because, like I said, this is a very broad letter from him. It's not, again, after this discussion about the previous two residents from Tucson, you know, that's what we had. And, you know, and the thing is here is, too, is, you know, another problem is, God forbid something happens during your residency and you get sued, or you're named in a suit and you have, all, you know, that could affect an early given license. That could not be a good thing. And, you know, we have, you know, you have colleagues across the country, too, that are completing their, you know, that, you know, giving special consideration. I mean, it doesn't follow protocol for me. It's like the hospitals, you know, yeah, you know, you've got to have 36 months. And our statute states successful completion of a residency, and these days that's a 3-year, 36-month program. So,
not that this makes you feel any better, but the next meeting is February 12th. It's less than a full month away. And if you can work with you know, the board's executive director on getting them that information. I don't want to misspeak, but maybe it's something that can be added to.
No, we'll just continue it to the February meeting. That's not a problem. So we don't need to make a motion on that. We'll just keep it open.
Yeah. Yeah.
Thank you. Is Dr. Leah Gorman. Everything is in place. Doctor has a approved application. They also have a license in Pennsylvania, which is in good standing. Residency was completed in 7/31 of 19, a three-year program in St. Paul. So all of the criteria has been met. So I would move to approve the application for an issue of license upon receipt of appropriate payment. Second. Any discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed?
So aye.
Thank you, Mr. Rhodes. All right, so next we have an initial application for dispensing drugs and devices from Dr. Andrew Goodill. And looks like everything is complete. I didn't see any issues on his, on there. Did you, Heather? So I will move to issue the initial registration for to dispense drugs and devices for Dr. Andrew Goodill.
Seconded.
Any discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed?
Aye.
So moved. Next is Dr. John McGann. I do have a comment here. When applicants take photos with their cell phones, they need to make sure that full certificate is shown. That was, I thought, inappropriate for an application, because you couldn't see the whole DEA. Just a comment. So saying that, I would, everything is in place, the fee's been paid, so I will make a motion to issue Dr. McGann his initial registration to dispense drugs and devices.
Seconded.
Any discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
So moved. I know, Heather, we told Dr. Steck we would call between 10 and 12, and we're close to 12. The reason we're going to talk to Dr. Steck is he is interested in being investigated. And you've all reviewed his CV.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So if you, we're going to call him on the phone here. Get to him. Oh, he'll let you. So yes, right. So we're okay. And he didn't do anything.
No.
In the board office. Has somebody just joined the call? Mr. Rhodes, are you still on the conference call?
Yes. Yes.
We're just waiting for Dr. Stuck to join. I just sent him a message asking him to join the meeting.
Yeah, we can do that. While we're waiting for Dr. Stuck, we can go to the minutes. We have December 11, 2019 general session minutes. I think I found a typo. Let me see here. In the general session minutes, number five was with Dr. Benjamin. The word deceives was misspelled. It should have been devices, not deceives. So anybody have any problems with the content of the
minutes? No.
Okay, so we have a motion to accept.
Motion to accept the minutes as...
I'll second that. Second. Any discussion? All in favor? Aye. And we move on to December 11th, 2019, our executive session board minutes. Anybody have any issue with those? Any problem?
Motion to accept the minutes.
Second.
Thank you, Mr. Rhodes. Any discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? So moved. And then we have our general session board meeting minutes from the teleconference meeting of December 19, 2019.
Motion to accept the December 19th minutes.
Thank you.
Second.
Thank you, Mr. Rhodes. Any discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
Aye.
So moved. Thank you very much. I think we have Dr. Farrell on the line. Not Dr. Farrell. Sorry, Dr. Stack. Apologies.
Hi.
Hi, Dr. Stack. Thanks for being available to discuss your interest in and being an investigator for the board. We appreciate your time. We've all
Pardon me? I said my pleasure.
Thank you. And we've all had the opportunity to look over your CV. And I will say one of the reasons that I wanted to reach out or, you know, to contact you and of interest in this position is you had, I believe, a case a month or two ago, and I was, you know, real impressed with your care of your patient and your charting and your, and of course, your experience level. And now that we see so many more, you know, we have 3-year people are doing the 3-year residency. We have a lot more people doing ankles and rear foot reconstruction, et cetera, that we are in need of someone with good expertise and experience in that field. So that is my reasoning behind wanting to talk to you about your interest in this.
Well, thank you. I enjoy doing that, and I have, in my discussions with Heather, it sounds like something I would like to do. I don't have a lot of experience, I must say, right off the bat, on doing things like that, but I may need some guidance and maybe some teaching and points, but I'd be happy to learn.
Well, we have some protocols and things that set up, and I'm certainly sure I will not answer for her, but I know I'm sure Dr. Polakoff, one of our investigators, would probably be happy to speak with you, or of course myself. But it's a and Dr. Former and Dr. Ilana, you know, that it's an interesting process, and it's something that I think that, you know, you have the ability to do. And if you didn't think you did, you wouldn't have said yes or to talk about this. So I wanted to, if Dr. Foreman and Dr. Ilano have questions of you, or if you have other questions of us that we can, you know, have more discussion, or what kind of concerns you have. Now, your office is where?
I'm in Tucson.
So, it, I mean, you know, we have our monthly, you know, monthly meetings, and it's, you know, we do have, you know, the ability to participate telephonically, but do you, would it be an issue for you to physically attend meetings once a month? If you, I mean, you know, depending on what cases you had, et cetera, et cetera.
Once a month might be tough. I could do it occasionally, I'm sure, but every month might be a little bit difficult. It's a Wednesday every
second Wednesday of
every month.
Yeah, and you might, you know, there's, it might not be necessary every month. So I mean, we're just kind of, you know, if that's, yeah, you know, if that was like, hey, this is the day I always do surgery, or I have a clinic that's the only time I go to in a small town or something, you know, that's what we kind of need to, you know, with availability. And, you know, like I said, telephonically is okay, but you know, a lot of times I think being in person and where we can really have good discussions and you know, with a presentation from an investigator, I just think, I mean, I personally like the in-face better, but like I said, we do have telephonic ability too.
I would make every effort on those cases to be there, but I may not be able to make it every time.
All right, yeah. So, I mean, in scheduling, we really, I think we're very amenable to scheduling and trying to, you know, keep, you know, have it workable for everybody concerned. So, you know, and we can, you know, if you're in agreement, I mean, we can start with, you know, some very a basic case that maybe isn't as I don't want to use the word complicated, but is involved, just to kind of let you get your feet wet.
Sure. No, I think that'd be fine, and I could at least have, if the other investigators are agreeable, and I could call up with any questions and do something like that. And I don't think it will be a problem. I really don't. Like you said, otherwise I wouldn't have expressed interest, and I would do the very best I can to be available and to do the best job that I could.
So, Heather, what does the process for, he had apply with the state, or how do we?
Our board investigators are on contract, so I can just send him the contract to look over. As long as he's agreeable to it, he would sign it and start right after.
I'm trying to remember. We don't have to send any formal letter out or any.
There is a letter that.
Okay, I couldn't remember that.
Yeah, yeah. And so I guess I should say the letter is sent with the contract.
Okay.
And it basically says you have been accepted to be an investigator, and then the contract is attached. And as long as they agree to the contract, they sign it, send it back, they can start.
Did you hear all that, Dr. Steck?
Yes, I did.
Okay.
I did.
I thought, oh my goodness, I hope we didn't think we were ignoring you. Okay. So, any other questions?
I did have a question. Is this, when you are the investigator, is it always, known who the investigator is? The reason I'm asking is, you know, I know this is a small community, and I guess you could make enemies fairly easily by, you know, depending on how cases go and things like that and what's found. Is that something that's done anonymously or not, or how do other investigators deal with those issues?
Well, when there's a letter that goes to the complainant explaining that, you know, the process that goes on, and then the list of the investigators' names are listed on that letter to the complainant, and that way the complainant knows that the investigator may be calling them. Now, when you write your investigative report, yes, your name is on there as the investigator. So, yes, the licensee will see your name. And our attorney, Mark Harris, has a comment for you.
Thank you. And Dr. Steck, that's a great question. And I know that there's been some discussion about being present during the cases that you are involved with. And those are public meetings as well. And you will have an opportunity during those cases to present your findings to the board. And the board will have an opportunity to ask you any questions. And again, you know, that's all open. It's memorialized in the minutes of the board meeting. And also, by law, all board meetings are audio taped, and the tape recording of the board meetings are posted on its website. And I think they're up there for like a period of 3 to 5 years. So there's a lot of transparency in what the board does, and included in that transparency will be, you know, the names of the board's investigators.
Okay.
But that's certainly a legitimate question, yeah, because when a small community and, you know, being... It's an opinion. You have to be as objective as you can, and you don't take personality or person into account. You're just trying to analyze what happened, and that's it.
Very well said.
Sure.
Okay. And you can recuse yourself, correct?
And Dr. Steck, this is Heather Broaddus. I know you and I have had a lot of email correspondence, but I don't think we've had a phone conversation. So if you'd like to have a phone conversation with me regarding more of how the process works, you know, if there's ever a formal hearing, what happens with the investigative report, those kinds of things, I'd be more than happy to schedule a time to actually, you know, answer any questions you have on a phone call.
Okay, that sounds great. I appreciate it. You've been great, so that would be helpful.
Okay, so I can contact you maybe after the meeting, and we can try to set up a time then for that.
Sounds good.
John Rhodes, if there was a conflict and you knew the person, you can recuse yourself. Am I not right?
Well, right. Okay. What happened is he just wouldn't accept the engagement.
Yeah, he would just not accept the file. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
All righty. Okay.
Well, thank you for considering me. And
yeah. And Dr. Steck, you know, the other thing too is, you know, the people are discussing, you know, the more advanced work you do and stuff, there's always a chance that you get sued. And that's not a reason to preclude someone from investigating a case. And that, you know, I know a lot of people get concerned about that. But like I said, what we saw coming from you in your case you had with us a few months ago, I personally, and like I said before, I was impressed. And that's why I thought you might be a good investigator.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. Yeah, it's no fun to go through, but I appreciate your kind comments. That was very nice.
Thank you. All right. Well, like I said, Heather will, contact with her, and I'm more than happy also to speak to you. So we'll just proceed with that. And thanks for
Sounds
your time.
Great. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
No, thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Bye. Have a great day. Bye.
I do think.
Yes, we should make a, yes, okay, so on 5G, I will make a motion to forward to Dr. Jerome Steck contract for participation as a board investigator. Second. Any discussion? Any discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
Aye.
Thank you, Mr. Rhodes.
Okay.
All right. Okay. Mark has to go to another meeting.
Seamus
here. Well, keep indoctrinating.
Yeah. And good luck and congratulations to the future officers of the board.
Okay. Thank you, Mark. All right. So, guys, let's see here. And lady. We with compliance updates. We have... really, Dr. Farrell, and at that point, this is still open, so we don't need to What do you want me to do, Heather?
With Dr. Farrell, I did get a...
Well, that's right, that he didn't do any more. He didn't do any surgery.
He did one.
One. Oh, he...
Mm-hmm. And so he submitted the records to me yesterday afternoon, so I will be sending those to Dr. Polakoff.
I guess it was my confusion. I thought it was one of the ones that Dr. Polakoff reviewed today, so this is actually another one.
Mm-hmm. This is a new one, okay. So
that was my error.
Okay. So I'll be sending that to Dr. Polakoff, if not today, tomorrow. Okay.
And then Dr. Heyman sent his last-minute note that no osteotomies. Okay. All righty. So I, under the legislation that we have.
At the December 11th meeting, the board received a draft of the legislation that is being sponsored by Senator Brophy McGee. And one of the requests was that Section 32826A be changed to clarify that a residency program is 36 months instead of 3 years. So I requested that Michelle Hannigsberg make that change, and she did. So I'm just giving it back to the board for review, and if there's any other changes, modifications. On another note, our bill has been dropped, and it's been assigned SB 1087. And from my understanding, it is going to be held at the Senate Health and Human Services Committee next week. And myself and Dr. Polakoff, or I'm sorry, not Dr. Polakoff, Dr. Campbell, will be attending that meeting. The agenda is not posted yet, but I was told by a Senate staff that it's going to be reviewed at next Wednesday's meeting. And I've had conversations with Mr. Boddy, and I'm under the impression that he'll be attending the meeting and that the association has no concerns with the current legislation.
Let me find it on here. In light of what discussions and things we've had today, this is a point that I really want to be clear on. Is if you go under definitions, it is number 9. Podiatrist is synonymous with podiatric physician and surgeon and means a person who, within the limits of this chapter, is registered and licensed to practice podiatry by means of performing full body physical examinations and diagnosing or medically, surgically, mechanically, manipulatively, or electrically treating ailments of the human foot and leg, but does not, but not amputating the leg or entire foot or administering an anesthetic other than local.
So we could never do nitrous oxide.
Correct. And, but yes, right. And you know, the years when the amputation law came in, that's where we had that change of adding the amputation other, you know, not the leg and entire foot that you have to leave the calcaneus and the tail. Anyway, but my concern here is, you know, the performing of the, again, full body H&Ps, we had received a lot of questions from young doctors, you know, can I perform an H&P? So Heather contacted Russ Stoner at the Federation, and he did a call out to member boards. And as we were discussing earlier, that Illinois and Georgia, it's in their statute that they can perform H&P. I have a board colleague who practices in Georgia. I talked to him, and he said, yeah, but they can do it, but a lot of times it's left up to your hospital bylaws. So some hospitals allow it, some don't. But Georgia law does not prevent it. In the state of New Mexico, they also allow, and that's the part, though, of direct connection to what the local lower extremity issue is. And I asked Heather to contact her AP over there if they wrote a letter in support of the podiatrist doing that. I was feeling that maybe we were going to get questions at this legislative hearing that we should be there. and a colleague of mine, actually co-residents together that practices in California, and he says he does them. A couple of the facilities that he's on staff allows him to do it. But he always has medical clearance from the PA. And some hospitals restrict you to only full bodies on ASA 1 and ASA 2 patients. Anesthesia risk scale. So I just was trying to gather a little bit more information just for my own clarity, and particularly in light of what we heard today, a physician who's certified in a state, but so I'm just, I don't know if I'm winding up a hornet's nest, but I wanted to talk to you. Joe Buttons and Joe, and they didn't even see that issue. So, you know, I don't, like I said, am I opening up a can of worms here? Am I overly concerned? Because, you know, obviously, a doctor is going to have to prove that they're certified, that they have certification.
You can do an HMP, but I mean, the doctor's leaving themselves open to a variety of possible complications under kind of anesthesia.
Right. Like Albert mentioned. Question about that. So, you know, yeah, are they listening to hearts? Are they looking in eyes? Are they looking in? They just doing a review
assessment. No, I actually don't. I don't need.
I guess, you know, when we discuss this and bring it out, because they don't ask.
And Madam Chair, board members, just so you're aware, I did reach out to New Mexico yesterday and I left a message. I could not find an email online. So if any board member knows a contact in New Mexico, please let me know. But I'm hoping to get a response back. And then, too, from just conversations I've had with you, Dr. Campbell, it's part of dietist training.
Yeah, I was trained to do them when I was a but in private practice I never did because hospital bylaws and, you know, what about malpractice and training? Malpractice. I mean, I always, you know, did systems obviously and definitely everything like that, and the very focused lower extremity exam. And I always send my patients for pre-op HMP to their primary care doctor. But, you know, again, now with the 3-year residence, and we have to progress with the time to make sure we're appropriate.
Had an HMP in their residency, I guess, class just like we did. I don't know if there's any formal HMP type certification for podiatrists.
About 33 years ago, we did any kind of a certificate. So,
personally, any good malpractice attorney can get you on the stand.
Exactly. So I just wanted to express my concern. Like I said, our legislative updates and we're going to open our licensees up.
I think you are going to open up to potential problems. Especially if your scope of practice by the state is just the knee down, and you're doing physical exams that inevitably you might miss something and you're going to be liable for it.
Yes, Board, I could say that confidently that if it's outside the scope of your practice act, your unprofessional conduct, then you could open up licenses.
Wouldn't it put a lot more exposure on the doctors?
Yes, Mr. Rhodes, that's what we're talking about.
Yeah. So, you know, I'm wondering now, Heather.
Change it to within the scope of statute practice. The Arizona practice statute.
I can reach out to Michelle Hannigsberg and ask if it's appropriate for her to make a change. And even if it is, I don't know if she can do it this quickly before the first hearing, but it's something that we can, I can find out the information, and Dr. Campbell and I can always take that information to the hearing, and they can amend. I'm just not, with session started, I'm just not sure how quickly everything will move with how busy all of the staff is going to be right now, you know.
So if a podiatrist wants to take a nitrous oxide class, we can't take it.
No, I only think dentists can. Yeah.
So it's only local. You need to get certified in.
Are you going to be the one administering and monitoring the patient? Interesting. I mean, that could be something that, you know. Nobody ever asks about, I've never gotten a question about
it. Actually, I did get a question.
I think at this point in time, that's going to be, you know, like I said, with.
In regards to the physical.
I'll let you in. Or was there any other, anybody have any other? Because most of it was mostly just wording and stuff. We've got the everything in there about fingerprinting and everything else. Did you guys, was there any other of these?
We do have to put something out about getting fingerprinted now, but obviously that's going to be a bigger.
Well, that'll end up out on what the application is. No, we'll see what.
Yeah, if this does go through the process and as in fingerprinting is implemented, I believe the effective date isn't until September 1st, maybe a little bit later. But I'll be sure to put something on our website. I don't know that sending an email blast will help, but I can let the association know. I don't know how much that will help, because this is going to be for future applicants. You know, people who are just coming to Arizona to apply to be licensed. But I'll definitely make sure it's on our application and on our website in advance. And then just for my clarification, when I reach out to Michelle Hannigsberg, I'm just going to ask her to remove performing full body physical examinations under definitions number 9. Is that the direction the board is wanting me to go in?
Yes, in my opinion, yes. I think my other board members are in agreement.
Yeah, something within the scope of practice. Yeah. Examinations within the scope of practice.
Right, yeah. So now we have to do board election. Nominations for our board president and board secretary.
I would move to nominate Dr. Barbara Campbell as president of the board for the 2020 cycle.
Okay.
I second it.
You guys have to do. I have to. I can't take the vote.
I think you would just abstain from.
Yeah, that's what I'm abstaining. So,
any discussion? Okay, all in favor of Dr. Campbell, board president for the 2020 session.
Aye.
Ayes have it. Congratulations, Dr. Campbell.
Congratulations, Dr. Campbell.
And
you bet.
We have secretary. Any Mr. Rhodes, would you consider continuing as taking the nomination for board secretary?
Yes, ma'am, I would.
All right. So I will move to nominate Mr. John Rhodes as board secretary.
Second.
Discussion, all in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
So aye.
Thank you, Mr. Rhodes. You can't vote. You had to abstain here. Okay.
Abstain.
All right. Now, Heather is executive director's report. Thank you, gentlemen, for the vote.
You bet.
The first matter on my report is just the rulemaking progress. I don't have an update on that. I'm still waiting. I have reached out to OSPB. I've reached out to Ms. Rajakovich. I'm calendaring it every month. I'm hoping to get a response. I know it's been a very long time since I put in the exemption request. I'll keep the board updated on that. Emily Rajakovich, the current director of boards and commissions, has accepted a new position. I believe that today is going to be her last official day, but she did indicate that she'll help the transition with the new director of boards and commissions, who's Trista Guzman Glover. So I'll be sending my request to her instead. CE Broker, the contract is now effective. The entire process takes about 3 months. I had an initial phone call after the contract was signed, just to give me a timeline. So as things progress, I'll let the board know. And then the last item, and I just added this yesterday after I received an email from Dr. Foreman, and I have been aware of this for a couple of months, so I apologize for not bringing this to the board sooner. I have had conversations with the AG's office, and the AG's office is aware of it, but basically there are individuals out there who are impersonating board members, and just be aware that everything is online, just like Mr. Harris said earlier. The board is completely transparent. So our audio files, our minutes, you know, all of our board members, any action the board takes is on our website. So any individual can easily go on our website, look at it, you know, who our board members are, see what dates our meeting are, see what licensees were at the meeting, everything. So basically, these individuals are calling a licensee, whether it's, you know, the medical board, the nursing board, and saying, hey, we saw, or this is board member so-and-so. You know, you recall that you were in front of the board at this meeting date, and your license is now suspended, and you have to pay this fine in order to have your license be taken off of suspension, and they ask for credit card information over the phone. So just so board members are aware that this is happening. I know other agencies are aware of it. It sounds like Banner has put out an alert on it. So, and I don't know if the AG's office has done anything, but I know I've spoken with Frankie Schen-Eckberg, and Mark was aware, Mark Harris was aware of the situation too. So I'm not sure if there's anything that's been put out by their office. And Dr. Campbell had mentioned that I could forward the information to the association as well.
Mm-hmm. Have you had any?
No, that's from Joe, actually. So.
Oh, Mr. Abadi?
No, Leonetti.
Oh, Joe.
Oh, Dr. Leonetti. Okay. It's like, well, then the association knows. So, and this board has not had any phone calls. At least I haven't, but I know other boards have. I want to say maybe private post-secondary was one of them. And I know at least one other agency in this building has had a call like that. And there's a current complaint log in your red folders. There's only been one change since I sent out the materials. And then I don't have any new information on the budget unless any board member has a question.
No summary of current events?
No, I don't have an update on any bills that are, you know, currently pending. It's a little early in the session, so as those pop up, I'll bring them to the board. So other than, you know, the podiatry board's bill specifically, I don't have any information on any current bills.
Discussion of possible items for future meetings. Application reads. You gentlemen have anything else?
Madam President, members of the board, were we going to skip the call to the public? I know it seems poor FOMA. Oh, sorry. I didn't. I apologize.
And our next board meeting will be February
12th. We're here to see again. No, there's only two room changes, and I'll make sure that I include that when I send the board materials out.
Could you put that in bold?
Yeah, I know.
So at 12:32, I will move to the second. Discussion. All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed?
Aye.
Thank you, Mr. Rose. So moved. Thank you all.
Thank you.
How are you feeling, John?